from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. A recent report by PolicyLink and USC found that a family of two workers on minimum wage can afford the median market rent in only 5% of neighborhoods across the Bay Area. Housing activist Randy Shaw finds these numbers incredibly troubling.
The illusion of neighborhood preservation or preserving neighborhood character has become to mean don't let apartments be built in our neighborhood. And it's had devastating consequences for millennials and the working and middle class of today.
Coming up, Randy Shaw joins us to talk about his new book, Generation Priced Out, and what can be done to mitigate the ongoing housing crisis in the Bay Area. Join us next after this. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. San Francisco has become the, quote, poster child for urban unaffordability. That's what Randy Shaw declares in the opening pages of his new book, Generation Priced Out. Randy Shaw is a longtime director of San Francisco's Tenderloin Housing Clinic, and he argues in his book that conflicts between homeowners and renters have stymied efforts to expand affordable housing and reduce inequality. And he also is going to join us to talk about the continuing housing crisis and what citizens and cities can do to encourage more inclusive neighborhoods. We're going to talk about the problem and the solutions, and welcome Randy Shaw.
Thanks for having me, Michael.
Good to have you back with us. Let me give this thesis to our listeners, because it may exacerbate, I was joking about this, but whole new militant conflict between millennials and boomers. The last one I remember was over Social Security. But essentially, you're arguing here that affordable housing, expansion of affordable housing, has been thwarted. And it's been thwarted by what we could call entrenched power. Many progressive people and people who are on the liberal side of the ledger, but they have privilege, they are homeowners, and there's a generational battle because they try to restrict housing.
Well, boomer homeowners, this is what I discovered in writing Generation Priced Out, is boomer homeowners, primarily boomer homeowners, have prevented apartments from being built in vast stretches of residential neighborhoods in all of the major cities and all the progressive blue cities over the dozen that I discuss in the book, whether it be Minneapolis, Portland, Seattle, Austin, Denver. They restrict development so severely in these neighborhoods that it forces people to artificially creates a scarcity, which increases our own home values, makes everything else more expensive, and forces the 120,000 people now commute from Sacramento to the Bay Area every day because they're priced out of the progressive Bay Area cities due to boomer housing policy. And it's a sad comment. I am a boomer, but they have not addressed what needs to be done for the housing crisis.
Well, you're talking about political power here. I mean, these are homeowners, so they have power over zoning and land use and decisions and NIMBYism.
Yeah. Right. And in many cities, all the cities I mentioned, in places like Berkeley, homeowners are given enormous power to protest, appeal, show up at hearings. And the legislators feel like they have to listen to them because those are the people giving them money and giving them votes.
This is a national problem, as you've indicated. I mean, it's spread throughout the country, and it really has national resonance, this split, this gap.
Well, what I do in the book is go city by city, and you can almost get the same refrain from homeowners in every city. Los Angeles has a terrible housing shortage and the worst homeless crisis in the country. They also have powerful homeowner groups that even try to get accessory dwelling units stopped everywhere. These powerful homeowner groups, which are very wealthy in places like Los Angeles, exert disproportionate impact. And studies have been done showing these neighborhood councils are disproportionately upper-income white homeowners and don't really represent the demographics of their own neighborhood. Yet and that's what we're trying to change. That's what my book talks about, how to overcome that power.
Which I definitely want to get to. But housing affordability and rising inequality in cities, which is a national story, has to do with entrenched power of boomers, essentially. So what we have here is not so much the story or the narrative we often hear about developers and speculators as the villains. It's we're talking about now?
It's very interesting, Michael, because there was a recent Los Angeles Times poll which said that most people think the problem with affordability is, quote-unquote, greedy developers. And what I always say to that is, when a boomer homeowner whose profits are going up, whose property values are going up exponentially because they're restricting housing, are they going to tell a pollster who's responsible for affordability? Well, I am. I'm really, because my greed, because I'm not letting anything get built, that's why things are so expensive. Or are they going to blame greedy developers? I think they blame greedy developers.
Well, speaking about greed, I mean, You have some figures here. Obviously, if you keep the neighborhoods a certain way, you keep the value of the housing up. And we've got Proposition 13 to play into this whole occasion too, this whole equation, excuse me. But affordability rising to about, what are the figures you have here? You're talking about people making in a course of 6 years about $1 million?
Yeah, the equity is astounding. And there was just a house sold this weekend. The Chronicle did a story on it, 1,100 square foot cottage in Virginia Street in the flats of North Berkeley. It advertised for $875. It sold for $1.5 million. And this is what we've done. So by restricting supply, by preventing apartments being built on transit corridors, if you want to live in that North Berkeley area, you have very few choices. So they had 200 people come to that open house because there's just nothing getting built in those neighborhoods of Berkeley.
And let's talk about the logic of this, because as you say, many of those neighborhoods in Berkeley and San Francisco and Oakland are essentially homeowners who see themselves as progressive. They drive Priuses and all the rest of that, as you point out in your book. But housing affordability becomes to some extent an ongoing terrible problem for the millennials and for those who are looking to get into the housing market. We're talking about teachers, nurses, firefighters, janitors. I mean, people who make a normal kind of living, or what used to be in the 70s and 80s, a living that could buy a home but no longer can buy a home.
Right, and many of the boomers who are most opposed to allowing the teachers and the nurses to be able to afford housing in the neighborhoods themselves were middle class or working class, and you could buy a house in Berkeley you could buy a house in Noe Valley for under $200,000 in the 80s. You know, now it's 1.52 million.
What I was going to say is these should be natural allies, though. I mean, that's an important point that you make, because there are people who don't want the long commute. They want to help the environment. They want to drive their Priuses to help the environment.
Well, it's interesting. The environmental analysis kind of falls down. They feel because they drive a Prius and recycle and may have solar panels, they don't seem to pay attention to the fact that not allowing infill housing requires people to commute and expel greenhouse gas emissions, which is just the report just came out this week. The worst cause and source of climate change is greenhouse gas emissions, which is caused by telling people you have to live in Sacramento or Fairfield or Vallejo because we're not going to make it affordable for you to live in Berkeley, Oakland, or San Francisco.
The big inspiration for you here, I mean, you've been a housing activist many years and you've actually gotten bills through, and the legal side of the ledger is pretty heavy in terms of Randy Shaw's input as an activist. But the Ghost Ship fire really got you started on this.
Yeah, well, people may, you know, it's we're coming up to the almost 2 year anniversary. It was December 2nd, 2016 of the Ghost Ship fire. And that really, that's how I ended up writing this book, because here you have some, you know, sort of the best and the brightest, the artists, the bohemians, you know, at a party in Oakland. And it turns out the building is completely fire unsafe. There were no fire exits, no fire sprinklers. 36 people die after just going to a party. And it led me to think that, wait, what is really wrong with here, where Oakland used to be the affordable alternative to San Francisco? That's where people went because they couldn't afford San Francisco. And now they can't even people like that can't even afford safe and affordable housing in Oakland. And it got me thinking. Originally, I was going to write the book just about the Bay Area, about how these three progressive cities, Berkeley, Oakland, and San Francisco, were all excluding the future working and middle class. But then I started looking at other cities and found the same story in Los Angeles, Austin, Minneapolis, Seattle, Denver, Portland, San Diego. It was the same kind of conflicts. And that's what I think is really kind of a hidden cause of our national housing crisis, which is not building enough housing in areas which progressives control. I mean, this is not something, these are progressive cities who somehow don't pay attention to the land use policies and what they're actually doing.
You also have the sense of exclusivity in this keeping people out, but also neighborhoods that are – I'm just looking at your book here. San Francisco's fabled North Beach and Haight-Ashbury neighborhoods long housed poets, musicians, and representatives. David Talbot has written a lot about this, of the city's counterculture. Today you need the salary of a bond trader or a corporate attorney to find a vacant one-bedroom apartment in either community.
You can't get a house in anything in the Haight-Ashbury for under $2 million. And, and North Beach, of course, they don't build any – if there's virtually no affordable housing. There's no homeless services there. So we've created, and here's the interesting thing, Michael, is people who oppose housing will say all they build is luxury housing. But the real supply of luxury housing in San Francisco and Berkeley are the existing single-family homes, and I cite that in the book. The units that are selling for millions of dollars are the homes that people have seen appreciate in value significantly more than they otherwise would because they've restricted the supply.
Talking with Randy Shaw, and he's director of San Francisco's Tenderloin Housing Clinic. He's also the author of a book called Generation Priced Out, Who Gets to Live in the New Urban America? So let's talk about solutions. And there are solutions. There's actually some hope on the way here that comes through in your book. I mean, there's a lot that's being done.
One of the things I told my editor at UC Press is I didn't want to write a book just bemoaning the sadness of the housing crisis. I want to write a book about solutions. And most of Generation Priced Out is about solutions. And you, one of the things you start with, I say you have to have tenant protections, you have to have rental housing protections, and you have to build more housing. Because in San Francisco, Oakland, and Berkeley, we're doing a very good job protecting
higher
tenants.
Housing and denser housing, too.
Yeah, well, you have the whole west side of San Francisco, and this will surprise people listening. You can build a four-story mansion on the west side, but you cannot build a fourplex. Does that make any sense to a city that claims they want to promote inclusion and diversity? Why are we promoting mansions?
Why are we promoting mansions?
Well, because it's because too many of our progressive politicians make alliances with homeowner groups, and we have to change that. And hopefully, you know, we're seeing mayors elected in San Jose and San Francisco and Oakland that are very pro-housing and increasingly in Los Angeles with Mayor Garcetti. So I think that with YIMBYs coming along and millennials, for the first time, we have a movement that's a counterbalance to the boomer homeowners that have pretty much called the shots on land use for the last 30 years.
You mentioned Garcetti in L.A. I mean, Code Next is one of those innovative programs. Let's talk about that. But also, you say you use HALA as really a paradigm of what
other people. Well, Seattle does what Seattle, San Francisco did with Home SF, where they have a program where you allow increased density and increased height in exchange for mandatory affordability.
Give that acronym. It's Housing Affordability and Livability Agenda.
Right. And I think it's interesting in Seattle, even though the Great HALA Plan, which I talk about in the book, until last week it was held up by a lawsuit by homeowner group. You know, so this is what happens. The homeowners who lose in the public, they lose in the political process, they sue. But eventually Seattle, which cannot have rent control due to the state law prohibition, has to do, I think, and they can't have inclusionary housing, which is mandated affordable units in market rate projects. They came up with a very innovative solution that all the cities I've talked about in the book, Austin, Minneapolis, that also have these state preemptions, all should enact. We enacted Home SF in San Francisco, and it could be expanded if our zoning, if over half the city wasn't single-family home only. And people are going to say, why is San Francisco, that's a tenant town, why is half the land single-family home only? Well, that's why we have to change that, Michael. That's why I wrote the book.
Well, you do suggest, for example, taking away the power that many of these homeowners have over self-interested homeowners need to have, if you're going to get new housing, take away their veto power, take away their zoning power. How do you do that?
In San Francisco, which you can – in Seattle, they don't have the political process so involved. If your building fits zoning, you can build it. They don't
– it's a long process.
Half the time of San Francisco, which is why they build double the housing in Seattle. But here's the thing about San Francisco. Any member of the public can pay $617 for something called discretionary review and delay any market rate project for 3 to 5 months without any cause, without any justification, just writing the check. Now, other cities don't have that. Why does San Francisco? The Board of Supervisors could curtail that at any time, but they haven't. They need to do so. So my whole thesis of Generation Priced Out is that cities have the power to expand affordability, and they haven't done it, and we need to make them do it.
You're saying keep it local because there are some housing policy platforms. Elizabeth Warren's put one forward, so has Cory Booker. So is Kamala Harris here in California. But you're talking about really local-level changes.
I think it's also really important for people listening to realize that even though my whole life has been with low-income tenants and homeless people, housing them, the majority of people with rental problems in the United States need federal housing assistance. And 75% of eligible households do not get that assistance. So all those federal bills are essential. My book is about the working and middle-class people who earn too much for federal housing assistance and are left to the private market for the most part. So that there's clearly a whole world out there, a universe of people who are homeless, who need federal housing assistance, and we need those bills, and we need to triple and quadruple the HUD budget to make that happen.
Notwithstanding the need to subsidize the poor, you're talking about really lower class and working
class. Right, working people who have historically, the teachers, the nurses, the unionized hotel workers, who have historically been able to live in San Francisco, who now have to, you know, we have a teacher who who can't, we expect them to stay after school and work with kids and be head of clubs on campus. But if they have an hour commute, how can our teachers really do that? And San Francisco and all these cities, we're now doing some teacher housing in San Francisco, but we need to expand our supply, and we also need to use our public land more strategically, which I talk about in the book. We have these BART stations, which people always say to me, why don't we build housing in North Berkeley BART? Well, because the city of Berkeley adamantly opposed it. And finally, thanks to David Chu, our assemblyman in San Francisco, we got a bill passed that will facilitate building housing on BART stations. Berkeley joined with Orinda and Lafayette.
Former assemblyman. He's now a state senator.
I'm sorry. No, no, he's assemblyman.
I mean, David state Chu. Assemblyman, yeah. I just want to ask you more about solutions, though. Let me get back to that, because when you're talking about taking away veto power, for example, these entrenched homeowners, you're also talking about legalizing new apartments in all residential neighborhoods. In other words, the gentrification has to be made more diverse somehow. There has to be essentially an incursion into the residential areas that are gentrified.
Exactly. If you have inclusionary housing, which is below market rate housing as part of a market rate project in Noe Valley, that will be the only way a working or middle class person will be able to ever live in Noe Valley, unless their parents have money and they're paying for them. So people often act and sort of make believe as if most San Francisco neighborhoods aren't already gentrified. They are. And the goal should be to use zoning to get working and middle class people into those gentrified neighborhoods. And there's no risk of the housing causing gentrification that's already gentrified. And yet those neighborhoods are the fiercest resistors to apartments. And when I talk in the book about some of the videotapes that a guy in Minnesota, Minneapolis, called Wedge Live takes, and people should read that portion of the book or go to @WedgeLive on Twitter and see some of these videos. And I talk about there was a project in Minnesota, Minneapolis, where homeowners were down there and they were breaking down and crying about what this would mean to their neighborhood, this project. And they said, we're going to be calling 311 for emergency calls all the time. There'll be mattresses left out in front. And if you didn't know what the project was, you think, oh, I guess they're trying to put a drug rehab center or maybe a thing for ex-prison offenders. It was a 10-unit market-rate apartment building in a neighborhood that's 80% apartments. So the hysteria that homeowners feel toward renters. And I have to mention one more important point. In all of these neighborhoods, including the west side of San Francisco, apartments were allowed in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s. So there's already renters there who haven't wrecked the neighborhood. So it's a really strong anti-renter bias, class bias, that boomer homeowners espouse. And they do it in public quite frequently.
And you were talking about building by BART before, and I had mentioned raising height and density. That's all part of it. You got to raise height and density along, you argue, along the transit corridors.
Well, because of this state bill that David Chu got passed, we're going to be able to build on the North Berkeley BART station. But people are in panic. I'm talking
nationally now, though.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, nationally, there's public land in all cities. Because people often say, where's the land? And I talk in the book about what happened in New York City, where there was an armory that was not being used, and Bill de Blasio, instead of trying to use it for affordable housing, decides he wants to put luxury condos. And I have a whole story about how that was fought. So sometimes our progressive mayors, and de Blasio calls himself a progressive, are promoting housing policies, promoting exclusion and a lack of diversity. It doesn't make sense.
Again, we're talking to Randy Shaw, and he's director of the San Francisco Tenderloin Housing Clinic, author of Generation Priced Out, Who Gets to Live in the New Urban America. If you have some thoughts you'd like to share with us about essentially what Randy is presenting and what his book is all about, we'd like to hear from you. If you could do one thing to help alleviate the Bay Area's housing crisis, what would it be? And let me hear from you, our listeners, and let me tell you how you can join this program, because we would like to hear from you. Our toll-free number is available right now. It's 866-733-6786. The number again to call, 866-733-6786. Or join us by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. Or you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. This is all about banning new apartments and lengthy and sometimes uncertain approval process that doesn't allow, or I should say that allows long-time homeowners to essentially, I think the language that Randy uses in his book is make out like bandits, but also keep those who need housing, especially the lower class and working class, out. And also the banning of new apartments and a lengthy process that one has to go through to change that. It's all really a question of political will, isn't it, Randy?
Well, it is. And at one point, I think it's really important. Sometimes people say, well, I don't really want market rate housing. I only want affordable housing. But the ban on apartments bans affordable units, too. You can't build a nonprofit can't build a 50-unit project in the west side of San Francisco because the zoning prohibits it. So we're restricting where affordable housing can be as well, which is so that's a huge problem. I also want to emphasize that while we're talking a lot about building more housing, people will always say to me, we can't build our way out of the housing crisis. Right. We also can't not build our way out of the housing crisis. We have to do all that. My book talks about, again, you have to protect tenants. You have to protect rental housing. You can't allow demolitions of housing. You know, so there's a number of strategies. But what happens often on the social media world and the debate about housing, people say, oh, he thinks that if you just change the zoning, everything will be affordable. No, that's not what we're saying. And the book is more complex because it's not one magic bullet. Well, we have to do all of these things.
You also can't have a magic bullet when you take into account population growth.
Exactly. We have this problem. Silicon Valley hired all these workers in the 1990s. We had a thing called a dot-com boom. Did San Francisco build any housing? Did South Bay build any housing? And one thing I talk in the book is how the South Bay's failure to build housing has really hurt the rest of the Bay Area because they brought in so many workers without providing any jobs. We had the same thing happen in Austin where the tech workers are coming in and there's no housing provided. So, you know, we just saw that with the Amazon headquarters too, where they're coming in and they didn't provide any housing. Where are all these people going to live? Well, they're going to compete with existing residents, raising the price of rents and housing prices and homes. So we have to be more strategic in how we deal with the jobs, population, housing imbalance.
There is pro-growth, though, as you said. I mean, we see it in Denver and Seattle. We've already
Yes.
mentioned that, and you have all sections in your book devoted to Denver and Seattle. But also, you got housing bonds in San Francisco and Austin and Portland.
Well, I think, Michael, that these bonds, the passage, we just passed $6 billion worth of affordable housing money on the California ballot. And you know, Portland, in their county metro, they just passed a $685 million bond. Voters want to support housing, but sometimes the politicians and the power of the neighborhood groups and the influence they exert at land use hearings or it distorts their actual lack of broader political support. And I think we saw that in Austin where we had a big fight over a land use division. It was kind of killed by the homeowner groups. There was an election which was a run between the incumbent pro-housing mayor and the leader of the neighborhood group. The incumbent pro-housing mayor won by 40% of the vote. Yet everyone made it seem as if the voters were split in Austin. So I think we're seeing the majority on the side of dealing with this affordability crisis.
They realize the crisis, but at the same time, you've got exclusionary land use
yes, that's right.
laws that are maintained, as you point out in your book. And again, we'll go to your calls and emails. Please feel free to join us. Let me actually read a tweet here from Ann. She says, it isn't about greed. There are no retirement plans anymore. No company covering a pension or health care. Education costs are through the roof. Our house is our retirement, our emergency health care, our kids' education fund. We aren't greedy.
Well, I'm not saying they're greedy. I'm not saying every homeowner is greedy. I'm saying the homeowners who are trying to stop other people from building, this is wrong and it's not fair. The homeowner appreciation we've seen in San Francisco is far beyond people's wildest dreams. No one, when they bought their house, said, I'm expecting this kind of return on my investment. I don't think anyone did. It's just been through the roof. I mean, you can't get, you know, people are saying you're earning, it's the greatest job in the world being a homeowner. You're just $60,000 a year just owning.
We'll hear from you when we return. I'm Michael Krasny. You're listening to Forum on KQED Public Radio. Our guest this hour here in studio is Randy Shaw. He directs the San Francisco Tenderloin Housing Clinic and has been a longtime activist with respect to housing. He's also the author of a new book called Generation Priced Out, Who Gets to Live in the New Urban America? And let's go right to your calls. Let's begin, Craig, with you. You're on the air.
Good morning. I just want to say, you know, it's really perplexing to me that you know, we're not having a conversation about preserving the neighborhood that so many people worked at their entire professional careers to, you know, buy the homes, pay them off, and want to kind of finish it out in their neighborhood that they know and love and work so hard to fill. You know, I'm supposed to make way for Google and Facebook employees so that they can grow their business, and when they figure out how to do their business without, you know, the employees that they need right now, and they just leave the city like a barren wasteland like Detroit. I mean, there's a lot more to this than just we need. What about, you know, the people that have built these neighborhoods? You know, the growth that we've seen in the last few years, you know, all I see is so much more garbage, so much more homelessness, so much more drugs. You know, how has the growth benefited me except for, you know, this constant, you know, push for me to accept? Well, the answer is to put in high-speed rail out to places like Trail, Tracy, where people can just jump on the rail and get to work in 30 minutes and have the...
Yeah, Craig, you know, you got a bad line here, but I think we get the pith of what you're saying, and let me go to Randy Shaw.
Well, you know, I think the essence of what the questioner talks, he asked the question, how does growth benefit me? And I think a lot of people in neighborhoods feel like, wait a minute, why should I allow more housing in this neighborhood when it's already hard getting a parking spot on the street and we already have long lines at the coffee store? And so I don't want all those people in the neighborhood. And what this is the key issue of understanding where we are as a country and as a people. We just had a big climate change report released. We have people, so they're either going to live in the city where they can take public transit or ride a bike or a scooter or to get to work, or we're saying we're not going to let you build in cities. You have to go out in places where there isn't good transportation and drive to work, which impacts climate change. Which is why I think we see so many environmentalists getting involved in the housing movement, because they realize that if we don't deal with infill housing, get the housing built there, we have population growth. It's here whether we want to acknowledge it or not. And all of the cities that I talk about in the book are very pro-immigrant. If you said to them, we're not going to let immigrants in your city because of growth, they'd say, what are you talking about? That's terrible. Well, if you're pro-immigrant, you have to have a place for immigrant to live, which means you have to build more housing.
Let's go to another caller from San Jose. Jay is on. Jay, hi.
Hi. Yeah, we've been talking a lot about the demand side or the supply side, but what about the demand side? Looking at, you know, I live in San Jose, and here's Google going to be creating a campus with adding 20,000 more jobs. Why aren't there incentives for that, the jobs to go to cities where housing is affordable?
Well, that's a great point, and that's what people are asking in Queens right as we speak about why Amazon went to Queens instead of going to Charleston, South Carolina, or some of the opportunities they had in other places. That's a great point. You know, the tech companies and places like Amazon, they want a certain workforce, which is in cities. And that's why, again, you know, people often say to me, why is it so important to live in a city? It's because the higher paying jobs, the better education, and the better cultural opportunities are in cities today. And that's why the employers want to be in these areas.
Let me thank the caller and go to a comment here from Don, who tweets, I'm a former homeowner in San Francisco's Sunset District, and it is wall-to-wall row houses for miles. Almost no empty lots exist there. Where, then, would these theoretical multiplexes actually go without removing and scraping the current homes?
Well, there's sites in these areas, and I know people who in that area, and there are plenty of sites that you can build on, and I think that often,
I'm trying to think of sites in the Sunset, nothing's coming to mind.
No, there's commercial corridors that have commercial buildings that and vacant lots, and you know, I was just in L.A. and I could not believe how many vacant parking lots there were all over L.A. And yet they're sort of saying we have people in the worst commutes you've ever seen, hour long commutes, the 6-lane freeway, you know, terrible, and yet we have vacant parking lots all around attractive parts of Los Angeles that we don't build on. So the land is there.
Here's David, who says, I've been seeing these massive commercial developments around the Bay Area remain unoccupied for months and some even years. How about putting a stop to this? Build more homes instead of buildings. And here's Bruce, who says, please don't forget the absentee landlord. After the housing bust, many foreclosed homes were bought by investment groups. They are interested in maximizing profits and will push rents as high as they can. And we'll get as many callers on as we can. Let me go next to Oakland. Guillermo, good morning.
Yes, good morning. Yeah, I just want to make a comment that how good is if you change all the policies and existing regulations if you don't increase the salaries of the people who really needed it so they can afford to buy a house. The people who work in restaurants, teachers, construction guys, I mean, people who work in hotels, those are the ones who need to be increased their salaries so that they can make a decision whether they pay the rent or they feed their children. But before you're talking about changing regulations and changing policies, you should be talking about, hey, how do we help these folks?
Well, you have
to increase their salaries.
I would say, Guillermo, you have to do both. It's not waiting for one or the other. And in fact, in San Francisco, we've raised the minimum wage and we did it statewide. And that's one of the problems is that what union leaders always tell me is that they're whatever they win at the bargaining table is kind of lost in increased housing costs. So we needed to get raises for workers and the union workers, and we have to also make it more affordable so that all of the benefits they get from the higher wages don't go to the crazy housing costs we have here in the Bay Area and in all of our big cities now.
Guillermo, thank you for that call. Good to hear from you. And here's Jonathan, who says, talk some more about Prop 13. A four-story mansion will require services, streets, schools, etc., for one family, while a fourplex will require services for four families. The taxes on the mansion will very likely be sufficient for services to one family. The taxes on the fourplex will not. No wonder the neighbors, and particularly the city bureaucracy, don't want them.
Well, I don't think that's the reason at all. I mean, I think most people would say that given the need for expanding affordable housing opportunities, that you know, the cumulative property tax would probably be the same. I don't know that it'd be any different. The problem with the millennial boomer divide is that in the millennials that can afford to buy something are living next door to a boomer, and because of Prop 13 freezing their property taxes, millennials are also paying four or five times property taxes for the comparable home. And so the inequities of Prop 13 are well known. And I was happy to see that Prop 5, which wanted to extend Prop 13, was defeated in almost every county in California. Gavin Newsom has said as governor he wants to deal with the inequities of the California tax system. That's a good place to start with property taxes.
Talking again with Randy Shaw, his book is Generation Priced Out, Who Gets to Live in the New Urban America. And here's another caller from Hayward. Isaiah, welcome. You're on the air.
Good morning. I'm a tech worker in the Silicon Valley. I was born and raised in the region, and I've never left the region. And I know because I've experienced the ups and downs of our economy. And I don't deny the housing crisis, but I've always been suspicious of this build, build, build mentality because things could crash at any given moment. And why should we just satisfy the whims of the tech industry? The whole world cannot live in the Silicon Valley. The world is a very big place, and there's no reason that we should all cluster in this one area. Thank you very much.
Thank you for the call.
I appreciate the thoughts, but I have to say that we're not talking about Silicon Valley that has just seen excessive housing construction. We haven't seen hardly any housing construction. I mean, there's been a big battle in Cupertino to get 2,700 units put on the Valco former shopping center, and the neighbors are going, they're bonkers over it because they don't want it built. And it's a vacant shopping center, and there's going to be thousands of more Google workers coming into Cupertino and Apple workers coming into Cupertino. So I don't think we have that risk of the Silicon Valley overbuilding at this point. I mean, Stanford and Palo Alto, you know, I mentioned in the book that Boulder, Colorado, which has extreme housing prices, the neighborhood groups there see Palo Alto as a model for what they want to be, which is an elite, primarily white homeowning community that keeps renters and people of color out. And that's the housing policy of Palo Alto.
Isn't a lot of this, despite liberal or progressive politics, have to do with the desire to keep the character of the neighborhood? They want to keep people out and be exclusionary because they argue that the character of the neighborhood will change?
Well, that's the problem when we use the word character to define either – it used to be historically race. I mean, that's why they did the original zoning. Exclusionary zoning was created.
Character becomes a euphemism for things
white.
Like race.
Yeah. And then you know now it's more class. But it's interesting. If you look at the most famous picture of San Francisco, the most famous photo is the row of Victorian Edwardian houses on Alamo Square with downtown in the background. What that photo doesn't show is right to the right of that house is an 8-story apartment building. Now, I wish that famous picture had included it, because then they'd say, wait, I guess apartments don't hurt the character of a city, because this is the most iconic photo of San Francisco, and they've taken the apartment out of the picture.
Gee, I remember when they said the Transamerica building will hurt the character of San Francisco.
Yes.
Let me get some more callers aboard here, and we go, David, to you. Welcome. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you, Mr. Shaw. Firstly, I have a question. Like, why is it so difficult for the supervisors to pass that law where you can oppose housing? And then what about eminent domain? Right across from the Chronicle is the Chronicle Hotel that's empty, and there are all these housing developments and existing homes or hotels that are empty and that could be occupied. Would you speak to that?
Well, you're probably talking to the world expert on the Chronicle Hotel, because our office has represented those tenants forever. There's only one left. He might have just recently died. They've been there for 50 years. And the building is actually literally uninhabitable, and whether the city wants to take it by eminent domain, they'd have to have a public purpose, and it's a complex legal process. But you know, there was an attempt in 2011 to deal with this discretion.
Well, housing would be the purpose,
right? But whether it's legal under eminent domain laws,
eminent domain is pretty difficult
to replace housing with housing. Eminent domain is supposed to be a public purpose, like you're building a community center or a park. Just to make it a different kind of housing use, I don't know if that's even legal. But here's the thing is, when they tried to reform discretionary review laws in the past, the people who come out in force from Noe Valley, the Castro, the Haight-Ashbury, Pacific Heights, because they want to keep that power to stop their neighbor from remodeling their kitchen. Most of the discretionary reviews appeals in San Francisco are stopping your neighbor from renovating as opposed to new construction. So my hope is if supervisors, coming the new year, we do it for just new construction. But you'd be surprised. Discretionary review, check the neighborhoods where it's filed. People in the Tenderloin aren't filing discretionary review. People on 6th Street aren't. It's the wealthy neighborhoods that don't want anything built in their neighborhood.
I thank David for his call and go to some of the comments that are coming in. Here's a guy who says, please ask Mr. Shaw if the housing density in Manhattan is the YIMBY ideal. Then ask him why. A studio apartment in Manhattan rents for nearly $3,000 a month. More housing does not equate to more affordable housing.
Well, Manhattan is a whole different subject because they have a whole different kind of housing market. Manhattan's got tens of thousands of vacant units that foreign buyers use for weekend. Every year they come in once every weekend. So I always say, let's not talk about Manhattan as a model for anything. But
what about the notion that the emailer says that you have more housing, it doesn't mean you're going to drive down the cost of housing?
Well, I think Seattle has actually shown that that does mean you're going to drive down the cost of housing. Now, will it ever be at affordable 1980 levels? No, but it does slow the growth of increases. And Seattle's going through that right now. There's a story in today's Seattle Times by Mike Rosenberg, which talks about Seattle home prices are falling more than any city in many major cities in the United States. So it does. And actually, San Francisco rents and home prices have stopped accelerating at those levels because we're bringing more supply. So increasing supply does make a difference. Again, it's not the only thing. And when you increase supply solely by building downtown high-rises, like what's happening in Denver and to some extent in San Francisco and in Berkeley along the small housing along downtown Berkeley, you're not really serving the families in the middle class and working class families because they want to be in other neighborhoods.
Where are all those Microsoft employees living up in Seattle for the most part?
Well, I don't know. Understand Seattle's housing market because Amazon was hiring 9,000 workers a month, and you can't build fast enough to keep it up. And now Amazon's hiring has gone down, but every available unit. So that's why Seattle experienced enormous rent hikes, but I think we've tried the experience of not building housing. We haven't built housing in San Francisco for decades, and gentrification flourished in all those neighborhoods. Noe Valley, the Haight, Bernal Heights did not become gentrified because of development. There was no development.
Let me read a couple comments. Lorraine says, it's a sad commentary on our society that a critical survival need like housing is a for-profit commodity. Charge whatever you want for luxury housing, but basic housing should be within reach of everyone who wants it, especially those who work hard for their money.
Well, that's how Europe views it, and that's not how America has seen it. And really, since the mid-1970s, America's federal government has gotten out of the affordable housing business, which it's really a tragedy.
Ted writes, I suggest that those priced out of an area should relocate and find work elsewhere if there are insufficient numbers of people available to fulfill the myriad jobs that don't pay a living wage. It can only force wages up such that people can afford to live where they work.
I hear that a lot, and I discuss that in the book where someone in Berkeley says that why don't the tech companies just move to Idaho? Well, you know, the reality is first a lot
They're talking about Detroit, in fact.
Yes.
they took a whole array of people there.
The reality is if someone says, okay, I can't afford San Francisco, so I'll move to Fairfield, but what job are they going to get? I mean, San Francisco is the biggest job creator. I mean, L.A. is a huge job creator. The cities are where we're creating the jobs. They're not being created in the suburbs, so why suburbs are getting more poor. So I think we should focus on what we can do, which is we can build more housing in all of our cities. And in many of our cities I write about in the book, like Los Angeles, you could build hundreds of thousands of units and there's so much vacant land there. It's just really a question of political will and breaking through and using the young people, the millennials who are now showing up at land use hearings. You know, many are in YIMBY groups or they call themselves, you know, there's groups that I write about all over the country. it's really changing the tones. We just won a big victory in Minneapolis last week where they are going to allow triplexes in every residential neighborhood, in addition to other density increases.
This sounds like what you would call the right direction.
Yes.
We're talking to Randy Shaw again. His new book is Generation Priced Out, Who Gets to Live in the New Urban America? And we'll go to another caller. That's Katie. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Thank you so much for taking my call. I just wanted to offer some perspective as a millennial. I'm 31. My husband is 34. I graduated in 2009 during the economic downturn, and getting a tech job, which is what I currently have today, was really my only option, even though my preferred career would be in nonprofits. So I feel like first of all, I think it's unfair to blame tech workers for having jobs in the Bay Area. And secondly, you know, my husband and I were pregnant with our first child. We live in a rent-controlled unit in San Jose. Fortunately, we're very lucky. And I feel like we're really in a catch-22 here where he's a teacher. I don't make six figures. And we really cannot live anywhere else where there are jobs. He loves his job. He's very involved with the union. We're pro-union. But we just don't really have any other options. So I do think it's unfair. Millennials do need a place to live, and we need jobs. And as somebody who grew up in L.A., very low income, I don't have the family capital to support any kind of home purchase. So for now, again, with our future child coming along, we're very, very grateful to even be living in a rent-controled unit in San Jose.
Katie, thank you so much for your story, have a safe and healthy birth.
I thank you so much for calling, because you make the case that I make in the book, Generation Priced Out. It's a voice from the book. And I really think I want to make the emphasis point is that I say in the book, the way in which boomers malign tech workers, blaming tech workers for skyrocketing rents and housing prices in San Francisco when tech workers were the victims, and the attacks on tech workers that boomers waged when they themselves are sitting on million-dollar homes and aren't having to pay the housing prices, the tech workers. We've taken the millennial generation, we've saddled them with massive college and graduate school debt, and then we've said, now you have to go out and pay $3,500 for a one-bedroom apartment. And then we say, housing prices are going up because you're here. It's really wrong, and it did not reflect well. And the media, unfortunately, and I describe in the book how the media sort of fed on this, like, tech workers are villains, and let's all be bashing the Google buses. And, of course, Google buses were a progressive transportation mode, so people didn't have to do single cars. In the 90s, we all attacked the tech workers for taking single cars to Silicon Valley. So then the company said, let's do buses. Now they're attacked for taking buses. So this notion that the millennials are the victim, are the villains instead of the victims, is what I describe in the book. And I think she speaks for many of them, that many of these tech workers, even though they do have higher salaries, they're coming out of college with enormous debt, and which we didn't. Michael, you and I in our generation, when I went to Berkeley, I spent $212.50 a quarter. So it was a whole different world, and we didn't. And I think there's
the 70s and the 80s. It was affordable in the Bay Area for ordinary working class people, and that has changed in a quantum way. Here's Denise, who says, to say there is no housing growth in Silicon Valley is wrong. I am in Mountain View, and all over is build, build, build. Where is the green space? We need a broad conversation. Well, we're having one. Thank you for that, Denise. And let me get another caller aboard. It's William from Belvedere. Good morning.
Yes, thank you very much. I've learned a lot by listening to the different comments and the guest. I have a question for the guest. Everybody's an individual, and he did mention the reasons why someone with a single-family dwelling would not want to have a big building built in their neighborhood, traffic, extra garbage, crowds, etc. Could he please say why that's not a legitimate concern? And if he doesn't feel that it's legitimate, then in essence he's saying, these things are okay for you to care about these things, but I'm afraid we're going to roll right over you. That's the circumstance, then I can very well understand why the local homeowners are very resistant.
Yeah, I think you mischaracterized, so I want to clarify what I said. In the west side of San Francisco, the building would be the same. It's a four-story building. It isn't like a choice between a four-story building and a 35-story building. They're both going to be four-story buildings. You're either going to have one have four units or one have just one unit, a mansion. So it's the same size building. And In an article in beyondcron.org, which I edit, I showed some pictures I took of an Austin neighborhood that only allows single-family homes. There's been a mass demolition boom because people tear down the historic single-family homes and build these awful-looking mansions, but they're allowed because they're a single unit. If you tried to build an attractive fourplex in Austin or in the west side of San Francisco, you couldn't do it. So it's really the same size structures. Now, in transit corridors, it's a different story where you can get higher heights. But in neighborhoods, it's really whether you want a mansion or a fourplex. And I think most people in the Bay Area would say a fourplex is totally fine.
Let me thank William for his call. And here's some pushback. Listener tweets, I hate to say this, but your show is demonizing homeowners. Not fair. I know a lot of owners who want growth. Let's have Mr. Shaw discuss rent-controlled residents who do not want growth.
Wait a second. I didn't mean that. I wasn't demonizing homeowners. I'm critical of boomer homeowners who are not supporting opportunities. There are many homeowners who support more housing. I'm a homeowner. I support more housing. I mean, there are many homeowners who do. So if that impression was given, I'd like to correct that.
But that same tweet raised the whole question of those who have rent control who do not want growth.
Well, the rent control is a different issue with growth because they don't have any equity. I mean, there's people who have rent control who have a variety of views on housing and many of the and so I'm not sure exactly what
maybe that listener can tweet some clarification of that. I'm not sure I understand it either. But let me get some more calls in the meantime, and we'll go to Richmond. Ron, you're on.
Good morning. So this is music to my ears. Been a thesis of mine for a long time. But I don't want to see necessarily more construction along transit corridors or more long-distance transit. Transit is grief. I mean, commuting is grief. What we can do is we can look and see the net in and out commutation in places like San Francisco and the financial district, let's say, for example, in the morning by counting heads in cars on major thoroughfares and freeways and bodies on mass transit. And you can tell where people are flowing into during the day and out of in the afternoon. And that is the problem. You look at that and you say, okay, where they're flowing in, you have to have more housing. Where they're flowing out, like, you know, the far-flung suburbs, maybe there should be more enterprise. And I think what we have to do is we have to have regional authority or state authority that can basically slap a tax on places that are net in destinations during the day that can be used to possibly to acquire land and property for creating the housing that's needed. But you know, more transit and building more stuff at the transit stations. I mean, if you've taken BART in the morning, for example, you know, having more people trying to get on BART in the morning is not going to help. We have to make it hurt. You know, Adam Smith's invisible hand right now is giving us the finger, and we've got to take a look at that and say, look, if you want to live like this, if you want to live in San Francisco or build a business in San Francisco and move more employees to San Francisco, there's going to be a tax based on the amount of net in commutation to that city that's going to fall on properties. And it's going to keep falling on properties until you guys deal with your problems.
Yeah, Ron, let me thank you for the call and go to Randy Shaw on this. What do you think about his idea of a tax?
Well, I mean, there are taxes on development in places like San Francisco, but I think a point that I mentioned in the book, like in Denver, where the transit agency owns all this land adjacent to the new stations they're building, and I describe how what a great idea that they have in Denver to the activists to use that land for affordable housing. So the connection, that's why building housing on BART stations makes so much sense, because the public already owns the land so they can get a higher affordability rates. And that's what that will happen. Oakland's building 800 units on the West Oakland BART station. So I think that you have to connect the transit because you don't want people in cars. And I think that's really what what I realize in Generation Priced Out is the environmental movement has now become part of the housing movement, and that's why you see Seattle and Portland really getting involved in housing, because they realize we can do all these other things for the environment and climate change, but if we don't build infill housing, it won't make the difference. So
I think we got another caller on point here, and that's you. Jacob, good morning.
Good morning. I would like to ask the guest, because you mentioned earlier Amazon's housing challenges. Mm-hmm. What if companies like Amazon started building on-premises dorms where workers could come live for 3 or 4 days and then just go home? and I'll listen off the air. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for the call.
Well, I think Amazon should do something for housing because, you know, when you look at what the impact they've had both in Seattle and what they're going to have in Queens, it's going to be a nightmare. I say in the book that the book was written before they made their decision, but I say whoever gets that Amazon second headquarters is going to regret it. And I think we're already seeing that in Queens.
Try to get another call on here before we say goodbye to our guest, Randy Shaw. And Douglas, that's you. Good morning.
Good morning. I just want to point out, why don't they just put restrictions on Asian or just foreign buyers? I mean, something like 40% of our buyers are investors from other countries.
This always comes up whenever we talk about the cost of housing or affordable housing, not necessarily specifying Asians, but foreign buyers.
I don't think that's as big a problem in San Francisco as I don't think that's why we have a housing crisis in San Francisco.
I think it's not as big a problem as people think it is,
right,
but it's a problem.
Right.
I mean, there is a
right.
lot of investment.
Well, New York City made a terrible mistake approving these massive high rises in Manhattan that have no one living there.
Seconds left. I like Colin's question here about means testing. Colin, quickly, if you could.
I have many friends who make far more than I do who, have rent-controlled apartments in San Francisco. Would you support means testing for rent control? I mean, shouldn't it be a poverty program?
No, it never has been. Rent control has always been a middle-class program that helps people of all income levels. That's never been a poverty program.
But, you know, there are people who stay in rent control and have a lot of money and resources.
Also, as I describe in the book, a lot of the long-term tenants are always facing eviction and harassment because they have a low long-term rent. So I think that's not the way to go.
Always a good and provocative conversation with you. Randy, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Randy Shaw's book is Generation Priced Out, Who Gets to Live in the New Urban America. And we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. You can continue this discussion. In fact, we encourage you to do this online, kqed.org/forum. And if all goes according to plan, we will be back with you on the morrow. Thank you for being with us for these 2 hours this morning. And for all of us here, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.